Avian or something. The prickly leaves and dripping wax stung her scalp. It's the Scandinavian version of dreadlocks. Xavier rolled his eyes. Well, it looks stupid. Shasta snapped. Well, it's the law. Her fingers found the object of her search, and she pulled a cigarette lighter smeared with custard from the gummy morass. She offered it, asking, "Please?" Xavier took the sticky lighter. He sniffed it lightly, as if he might lick it clean. At the flick of his thumb, the lighter emitted a hissing blue flame. Shasta stooped to bring her candles within his reach. Doing so, she got him around one wrist and twisted his hand so she could read the title of the book he held. Atlas shrugged. Dr. Brawley had taught the book last semester. As he put the lighter to each wick, Xavier began to sing, "Happy birthday to you." Then he stopped singing and said, "We're all self-deporting. The entire Mexican diaspora is going galt, meaning all Hispanics, Latinos, Chicanos were headed south of the border. These white people are muy loco," he laughed. "After they all starve or wipe out each other, we'll come pick up the pieces." Mexico, in the meantime, would, as Xavier put it, blossom like something out of the Italian Renaissance. Shasta kept her head bowed slightly. Staring at her wooden clog, she asked, "Is there wax in my hair?" "European archaeology," Xavier continued, "has imposed its own bogus narrative on pre-Columbian everything. For example, he cited the paintings and carvings reputed to show Aztecs ripping out the hearts of human sacrifices. He knew for a fact such artwork actually depicted Mesoamericans conducting successful heart transplant surgeries. The lofty stone slabs atop their pyramids were in actuality operating tables placed where the healthy daylight was strongest." "Even more amazing," continued Xavier, "the paintings that showed tribesmen severing heads and holding them in the air as blood gushed and veins dangled from the severed necks." Shasta cringed. "Those grisly scenes," he explained, "were in truth proof of successful full head transplants." "White scientists," the young man half shouted, "have to deny what they themselves can't replicate." Near them, a young woman stepped up to peer into a shop window. The candle sprouting from her crown set the shop's striped awning on fire. Not far off, another young woman sipped a mocha at a sidewalk cafe, unaware that her candles were slowly igniting the Cinzano umbrella above her head. Xavier held the cigarette lighter for her to take. "Come with me," he demanded. "Leave these crazy gringos to destroy themselves." It was tempting, and Shasta definitely felt tempted. Her parents had already self-deported to the Yucatan Peninsula, not to mention that Xavier looked alpha macho hot, with just enough dirt smudged on his hip-hugging white jeans that they didn't read as gay. His gay brother had probably skated off to Geisha. No wonder Xavier wanted company. He was so alone. She accepted the lighter and snapped open her purse. "I'm supposed to give these pastries to strangers." She sunk the lighter into the sugary muck. "It's a weird ritual that goes with wearing a candle hat." Shasta was stalling, not wanting to break Xavier's heart. But she really needed to find Walter. To redirect, she offered the open purse. "Here's a chocolate eclair that doesn't look too mangled." Xavier got the message. He took the damaged eclair. The whipped cream bristled with stray hairs. Its flaky goodness was flecked with purse lint and embedded with stray breath mints. "Thanks," he sighed. He looked wounded, but still highly doable. "Thank you for lighting my candle," she said lamely. She turned slowly and step by careful step balancing her halo of fire, forced herself to walk away. It was a national disgrace, nothing less than a badge of shame as far as Charlie saw it. Blacktopia had only recently announced a successful launch of its new flying pyramid, based on a long-forgotten anti-gravity technology suppressed by Eurocentric interests. After centuries of white denial, the blacks had proven that pyramids built by the Egyptian pharaohs were, in fact, flying machines. While whites had been hiring esteemed film director Stanley Kubrick to dummy up convincing moon landing footage in the New Mexico desert, the blacks had kept their own functional method of space travel a secret for 10 centuries. Well, the secret was out. Charlie crouched in front of the television and watched news footage broadcast from Blacktopia. It clearly showed gargantuan Cheops-sized pyramids levitating off the ground at a military installation. These impossible stone ships rose into a blue sky. One great ship had already landed safely on the moon, near the site NASA had claimed as their own, in the fictional late 1960s stunt. In a matter of days, black astronauts would venture forth to explore the site. They'd find no American flag, no golf balls or moon buggy tire tracks. The white ethno-state of Caucasia teetered on the brink of total humiliation. To distract himself from the inevitable, Charlie cracked open a copy of the Talbot book. He read from it, even while his handlers entered his great throne room, to present selections of comely young women who hoped to become his bride. The television continued to goad, with images of huge pyramids floating above a prosperous landscape peopled by proud, beautiful blacks. Their dashikis flashed vivid colors. They carried themselves, men, women, and children alike, with the posture of nobility, with their spines straight, their shoulders thrown back, as if every citizen were an aristocrat. How Talbot Reynolds explained it, the smartest, most determined faction of blacks had been on a labor strike since 1600, or thereabouts. The idea of Adjustment Day had resided within them, like a seed for generations. To this end, they'd practiced their fierceness by targeting one another, knowing those in power wouldn't take note of a brother wasting a brother. According to Talbot, whites had practiced for Adjustment Day with school and workplace shootings. Gays had wasted gays with AIDS. The homos went to gyms and learned to destroy with their beauty. All the factions had been building a cold-blooded ability toward the future takeover. If they could acclimate to killing their own brothers and sisters without hesitation or remorse, surely they could slaughter their masters in politics, media, and academia. When the time came, they'd cease killing each other and turn their rage outward. This in-group collateral damage stoked each army's fury toward those safe, insulated so-called leaders who'd come to the fore buoyed on good speechwriters and kissing babies, but who'd never demonstrated any real physical power in the world. The opioid-addled NASCAR rubes, the grill-grinning, thuggish blacks, the sex-crazed queers, they'd rehearsed for Adjustment Day on soft targets in their own communities, and no one suspected anything would manifest beyond these in-group killings. And the practice taught blacks to shoot better. It taught queers how to smile their way handsomely into anyone's trust. And it schooled the whites about the patterns of flight that a mass of terrified people under fire will take. As Talbot explained events, they weren't a fluke. Adjustment Day had come a day closer with every drive-by shooting, every viral transmission, every letter carrier going postal. Once those groups had fully shed their humanity, it was only inevitable they would decimate their shared oppressors. On television, a vast flying pyramid hovered in the sunny, cloudless sky above the dancing, cheering hordes of Blacktopia. Their gold jewelry flashed, as did their smiles of complete joy and unbounded pride. It felt as if the white race had lost its way. It no longer had blacks and queers to feel superior to, so a key source of its pride was gone. Whites had been like a wealthy family who performed an ongoing pageant of morality and ingenuity to impress a household of idiot and degenerate servants. In the absence of queers and blacks, Charlie and his fellow whites had lost their motivation to live superior lives. Without underlings to dazzle, the white ethnostate seemed to be floundering. He muted the television sound and watched the jubilant dancing citizens of Blacktopia. The white race was like a father who'd survived his children. He had no one around to harangue or impress. No weak, flawed version of himself to lecture or rescue. Like a god who'd watched his last creation die. In the new, neat, orderly world of the white ethnostate, what did the future hold? The white race had met its every challenge. Could they make the grass greener? Make the trains run more exactly on schedule? Moments like this made Adjustment Day feel like a giant step backward. Following the risky social experiments of the last 300 years, white people could only return to a world of knights and aristocrats, a fortress of Norman Rockwell, Reader's Digest prettiness. A voice whispered in Charlie's ear, his majordomo alerting him, "Some female guests for your review, sir." The heel-clicking, kowtowing flunky filled him with sick disdain. Any man who hadn't taken part hands-on in the butchery sickened Charlie. He'd made his mark. Charlie had proven his valor, and that meant for the rest of his life weaker men would avoid him. Cowards would resent and despise his achievements. He would exist alone for most of the rest of his life, with none but his own counsel because his true peers were few. That's what made the selection of the perfect mate so all-fired important. Important, but hardly easy. Charlie set aside the book and clicked the remote to resolve the images on television. He scarcely needed to turn his head to take in the sight of the nubile young fillies being herded in, dressed in short pastel skirts that suggested Easter eggs. They fidgeted. Their doe eyes tried to capture and hold his attention. Eyelashes batted, glistening lips pursed. Some drew deep breaths and thrust out their chests. He wasn't fooled. How could they understand what it was to be anything beyond being female? They lived such corporeal lives, not believing in anything beyond the visible, the tangible, the openly stated. Amid this chaos of preening, one drew his focus. One among them stood with a regal stillness, her willowy limbs motionless. A potential queen. Her honeyed hair pooled on the shoulders of her richly embroidered peasant smock. Charlie could picture her swinging a scythe in fertile fields of golden wheat. Her loins would push forth a new generation of gods. Charlie would sire in her a horde of inventors and artists to revitalize the white race. He studied her ivory arms and the pear-shaped swell of each innocent breast. Her small feet were otherwise bare in simple leather sandals. Her periwinkle eyes hinted at a docile, animal intelligence. Charlie indicated her with the slightest flick of his fingertips, bidding, "Little one." At most, she appeared to be only a year or two his junior. Using his lordliest voice, he inquired, "How are you called, girl child?" For a breath, she stared back, speechless. Perhaps she'd heard how for weeks he'd done little more than glance at the parade of prospective wives. He'd yet to speak directly to any of the legions of attractive females. Her muteness added to her appeal, and Charlie felt his sex excited the idea of having her soon. When she failed to speak, the majordomo broke in. "Sire," the man said, "her name is Shasta."
"Shasta.
Queen Shasta. She would be his. Charlie's perfect Aryan consort." Few thoughts in her mind were her own. living on soda crackers and gin as she was. Miss Josephine dared not eat the food Arabella brought up. She assiduously flushed it in bite-sized chunks, but only late at night when no one would hear. Night and day she'd taken to leaving her little television play. She needed the company, despite how it was always just the Talbot man. According to him, the white folks were glad to surrender Jackson, Mississippi, just as glad as the blacks were to abandon Detroit. He said it was a 300-year embarrassment to ethno-Europeans that they couldn't till their rice plantations or cut their own tobacco or sugarcane in the sweltering heat. Michigan amounted to little more than snow and rusted fenders. Whites needed winter, said Talbot. Needed an enforced rest. Otherwise they went crazy with their labors. Blacks despised the ridiculous snow. One could picture Talbot, a performance on paper in his book, fully in character as saying such. Instances of lunatic insight, Miss Josephine called them. An insanity that passes as the new sanity. He said Southern whites had balked at migrating north immediately after the War of Northern Aggression because they didn't want to prove the New York Times right. They had no business in Georgia or Mississippi or Louisiana. But to tuck their tails and relinquish the South to its rightful occupants would be to allow the second shoe of the war to finally drop. Ethno-Europeans wouldn't miss those landscapes of kudzu and water moccasins. To retain Florida was to pose smiling with a dead body, the body of an infant daughter wearing a lace christening gown and a tiny pearl necklace, and to pretend that girl would someday come back to health. Florida was death to white people. As if he spoke directly to Miss Josephine, Talbot waxed eloquent concerning the miasmas and the swampland's constant pull toward decay and corruption. Nothing on earth could sustain the whites of the South except their own Scots-Irish obstinacy. Malignant breezes and steaming Everglades offered whites nothing except skin cancer and malaria. In the North, cities like Chicago and Philadelphia afflicted blacks with vitamin D deficiencies, malnutrition, and frostbite. Miss Josephine, perched on high in this cramped suite of rooms, rooms crowded as a junk shop with every silver cup and trophy, every diploma, diary, memory, and family Bible. She was the brain of things. A sentry in an isolated outpost. The spirit spirited upstairs. Among the spirits of the cellar's wealth, she'd ordered the entire inventory of brandy and Madeira port interred with her for safekeeping. The cases of it smuggled by blockade runners during the War for Secession. A drunken, fleeting impulse dawned upon Miss Jo. She could burn these treasures. The past rested in her hands, as a steward or an executioner. She could burn this house and all the flawed relics within it. Charlie knew what the problem was. You see, the white race had learned to sublimate its sexual impulses. It had learned to delay gratification and to invent electric lights and mammograms and botany instead of just jerking off to porn or polling every skank who needed it. The result was that white people, mostly white men, in all honesty, had created technology and gotten the kudos of a perfect civilization where stuff worked. Trouble came when other races didn't sublimate like they ought to. They just kept on railing every piece of snatch, AIDS or not, herpes or not, and kept cranking out the babies. You see, the white men had traded babies for the patent on everything good, and the royalties, which were considerable. Except, the white men had neglected the big race, the population race. That's how Charlie saw the situation. Seeing how the white man was so busy not fucking that he had energy left over to invent solar energy. But this left him losing the reins. It's all in Stoddard. You see, technology and babies always seek a balance throughout history. When technology got ahead, babies fell off, And when babies got ahead, then civilization fell behind. Right now, mankind's progress was about to get swallowed in a sea of other people's babies. And that meant giving up vulcanized rubber and reverse osmosis, because there wouldn't be the smart people needed to run those segments of society. If white people could slack off, if they could just take a break from anodizing everything and maybe just nail some pussy, then civilization would have a chance. Not that white women were much help. No. They were only just getting their feet wet by inventing X-rays and eBay. And they obviously did not savor the idea of giving up public accolades and putting their legs in the air. That's why Adjustment Day had gone down. It would give the few remaining alpha studs the chance to boost white numbers. It would remove the temptation of women's studies degrees and other horseshit that baited ladies to let their precious Aryan eggs dry up. Adjustment Day gave men like Charlie, with loads of sperm and not the best grasp of calculus too, the opportunity to catch up the game for the white team. Simple as that. Dawson hadn't the heart to cut off the woman's ear. It didn't matter how much she'd begged. She'd finally snatched up the carpet cutter and began to do it herself, then gave up in tears. She knelt there in the dust at his feet. Standing over her, he could see the top of her right ear was crusted with dried blood. Apparently she'd tried, likely several times, to slice off the ear by herself. Detail followed detail about her Adjustment Day. First, despite her request that students silence their phones, a phone began to sound an alarm. Another joined in. A chorus of phones were marking the same moment. Beeps and squeaks and dog barks, a cacophony. And it wasn't as if a smattering of students in the huge auditorium reached into their Hello Kitty and G.I. Joe backpacks and produced guns. The professor and her team of graduate assistants looked on in confusion as every hand reached down alongside a desk. A deafening chorus of countless zippers roared. Every student sat upright, extending an arm, and gripped in every raised hand was a firearm. "It looked," she said, her voice faltering. One of her trembling hands flailed in the air. A forest of black sticks were pointing at us. The short barrels of pistols, the longer barrels of rifles and shotguns, and in between were the muzzles of revolvers. The black sticks belched fire, a wall of muzzle flash and smoke, the smell of black powder, and a graduate student crashed to the stage with two thuds. She could hear nothing after the first blast. The graduate student dragged himself toward her. His legs remained where they'd fallen, but his torso and arms dragged themselves pathetically toward safety, dragging his ravaged bowels like greasy fringe behind him. He'd crawled his way near where she crouched behind the podium. Bullets and blasts of buckshot exploded the screen behind them and punched holes in the plaster walls. The only sound was the constant firing. She couldn't hear if he'd actually said the words. But as the graduate student extended his blue, dying, already dead hand toward her, his dead man's lips formed the words, "Help me." Around her, her precious team of adjunct professors, the team she'd carefully handpicked and spent years assembling and recruiting from other institutions. They were flopping like beach dolphins, mangled beyond anything alive, but kept leaping like Muppets and obscenely jerking as ordnance slammed into their corpses. She'd risked reaching out from behind the podium. Her fingers laced themselves between the boy's icy fingers, and she dragged his sodden bulk to safety. His head resting on her lap, he looked to be asleep. Dawson clenched his jaw to keep himself from asking the graduate student's name. Now with Dawson, the woman no longer sobbing, she looked at the ground morosely, muttering, "Only days shy of completing his doctoral thesis on gender fluidity." Her entire body seemed to convulse with the emotional pain. Just because he made some undergrads read bell hooks. They promenaded through his gardens, Charlie and his bride-to-be, idling among the ancient Roman birdbaths and classical Hellenistic lawn ornaments requisitioned from leading museums throughout the formerly United States. He pointed out a Babylonian garden ornament he found when they sacked the Getty. Hoping to impress her, he called her attention to a mess of yellow petunias planted in a Mesopotamian carved stone thing he got at the National Museum in Washington, D.C. Peacocks paraded their glory, but they were nothing compared to Shasta. Duly impressed, she looked at the million-year-old Egyptian statue of some lady. Charlie had his team painted Kelly green to match his new lawn furniture. Shasta saw it and said, "Neato." He wanted to show her the boss stuff he'd scored from the Art Institute of Chicago. Really old stuff. Stuff he hoped she'd like, too. The courtship screening was just about complete. They still needed her genetic test to prove she was officially white, but that was just a formality. One look and he knew she was white. The clear blue sky might have been modeled after her periwinkle blue eyes. Birdsong could not compete with her laugh. Such an innocent she was, so sweet, so naive. She still believed in global warming and the Holocaust. Charlie suspected he was ear-raping her, but he was nervous. He couldn't stop talking. He made her stand and admire the big candle holders he'd picked up at some church or another on Fifth Avenue. Solid gold or something, so it was okay to use outdoors year-round. He made her squat down, put her hands around one, and try to lift it, to see how heavy. She couldn't. "Pretty cool," she agreed. New junk was arriving daily. More old dusty catchers from the Getty. Stuff from the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, even. A crew of guys did nothing but unpack the crates and try to find spots to stick everything. As they strolled, he tried to impress upon her the difficulties of his life. Living as an aristocrat took some getting used to. Like, all the lives that hung on his every utterance, not to mention the rich food omnipotent moguls were expected to eat. This morning, for instance, he felt positively poop-raped by his morning bowel movement. Thus, their formal courtship had begun, and with it, Shasta's education. And Charlie read to her passages from the Book of Talbot. Slowly, he read that a woman decides early whether to love the soul within her womb or to discard it. Once that belly child is birthed naturally, be it black or brown or Asian, she can't help but to feel love and pride for it. An impulse that explains so much of women's artwork. On the contrary, a white man must find the newborn to be a healthy facsimile of himself before he loves it. For white men are so constantly under siege, beset by corrupt ideas and degrading efforts of lesser races, that the white man must be certain his offspring will be his loyal ally. In the glorious new world, Charlie assured her, all children would have value. Not even a homosexual child was worthless. Once it reached the age of declaration, it could be exchanged for an innocent boy or girl heterosexual raised by mistake in captivity by homosexuals. As minstrels serenaded them on lyres and pipes in daisy-dense fields, Charlie read aloud to her from the Talbot book. God alone can create anything new. We can only recognize patterns, identify the unseen, and combine things to create slight variations. He read, Adjustment Day was brought about by the resolution of resolution. As per Talbot, technology and morality have created a climate where nothing short of death resolves anything. Feuds live eternally on the internet. No one can escape any moment of his past. Nothing is forgotten. Conversely, men have adapted to accept shame and humiliation as a passing obstacle. No public figure, no matter how exposed and revealed to be a degenerate, leaves the public eye for long. There was no closure in closure. Adjustment Day occurred to resolve the fact that nothing could be resolved. On the radio, Talbot read the news. The Unified Council of the Lineages report that the body of the President of the formerly United States has not been recovered. He has been missing since Adjustment Day, and officials are investigating the possibility that he fled the government assisted by agents of a foreign power. Lineage spokesmen report that a bomb has been detonated in a crowded public street in the White Ethno State, in Blacktopia, in Geisha. And 2 persons, 6 persons, 18 persons are believed to be killed as a result. Terrorists working in league with the former president have claimed responsibility for the gas attack, arson, acts of sabotage. Citizens with information about these crimes should contact a lineage representative immediately. As the Blue-Black Book predicted, during times of greatest moral and ethical crisis, people will side with those noble leaders who possess the greatest number of guns. As Talbot had foreseen, a form of Stockholm Syndrome took hold. People accepted the new leaders because people wanted leaders, and the former were dead. The details of who would run the government were secondary to the everyday details of their own lives. Providing for their children, for example, or completing their work or education, or finding a mate. Those persons who stood to be most affected by the impending war felt a rush of relief. The citizenry was accustomed to adapting to the government's demands. The exact nature of the government was of less consequence. Naturally, many were offended by the violent means taken, but no one so much that he wanted to throw away his own life in protest. The dead were dead. Each person had been gifted with a dollop of intelligence. Each dollop met and shared with others. As per Talbot, our souls cling unto our bodies the way non-swimmers grip the edge of a swimming pool. Planes crisscross the sky, each plane load a population being relocated to their appropriate homeland. The young among them happy to take part in the largest social improvement in modern history. The older defeated. Households were packed and shipped. Those surrendering their property had gone online and selected an available home of equal value from among those forfeited by other relocated populations. In airports, families kept their children close and studied the photos on their phones, the video tours of homes, farms, and apartments for which they qualified. To call this a social experiment was incorrect. It would never be allowed to fail. Those involved must make it a success. 100 years past midnight, Delicious and her husband lingered in each other's arms after a conjugal visit in a bus station toilet stall. "They call Jarvis an Uncle Tom of Finland," said Gentry. Delicious asked, "What's that mean?" Gentry shrugged and shook his head. "Something about too many muscles," he said. "It's not a compliment." He gazed down a moment too long, studying the muck on the toilet stall floor. He asked, "Is that a Percocet?" Delicious wanted to ask if he and Jarvis fucked. Men would fuck mud. But she didn't want the wrong answer, so she kept silent. Perhaps whites had suspected. In recent years, white popular culture had stumbled perilously close to discovering the immense wisdom and power blacks had long concealed. Whites had imbued the fictional character of the so-called magic Negro with psychic talents and spiritual abilities that hinted at the immense gifts blacks actually held in check. But with the advent of Blacktopia, at last the sisters who'd acted the parts of based crackheads and morbidly obese welfare cheats going so far as to glue white women's hair to their own heads in a mockery of white beauty standards that the self-centered white buffoons took to be a compliment. These regal black sisters could finally cast off their Falstaffian roles and take their rightful place as unstoppable healers and knowers of great cosmic truths. In keeping with their birthright, Blacktopians strode languidly the broad avenues of their earth-friendly cities, their long limbs glowing, their women willowy and glossy with confident wisdom. Immaculate spires jutted gracefully into the clear skies, defying the Stone Age physics of the backward white man. Blacks didn't so much saunter as they glided in continuous movement. Theirs were not the jerking steps taken by citizens of Caucasia. The white man's language had no words for movement this fluid, smooth beyond smooth. More so with each shortcoming, the white language was falling by the wayside, and Blacktopia resurrected its own ancient tongue. Whereas white history was written in words, black history was written in melodies. Brothers shrugged off the mantle of violent, psychotic killers, characterizations so broad and coarse that only the crude whites were ever fooled. It had become an inside joke. How outlandishly could the brothers behave? How far could they push with their music before the white oppressors might begin to wonder if the whole performance was for their benefit? If they spoke loudly and laughed louder, it was to hide the truth that most of their communication with one another took place through mental telepathy. Free to assume their legacy as learned shamans, the brothers gleefully shed their brimmed caps and knotted kerchiefs, red and blue trappings of their pretend gang filiations. They laughed a final goodbye to the slippery ebonics with which they'd hidden their genius from the white man. Masked by those coded words were the formulas for alchemizing precious diamonds from sand, and the newly freed brothers called forth mass quantities of diamonds and manifested a like bulk of rubies and flawless emeralds, and fashioned the total of these jewels to create immense palaces that caught the sunlight and blazed within like heavenly rainbows, the likes of which the white man's puny stained glass cathedral windows could never approach. In Blacktopia, the people continued to sing their praise to the earth, and in gratitude, diamonds sprouted through the ground, the size of skyscrapers, and lanced the clouds like minarets. And molten gold bubbled up and hardened instantly to form domed palaces to house the faithful. Sheltered in this paradise of color, the blacks retook the destiny that had been withheld from them under white rule. For the first time in recorded history, black efforts would benefit only blacks and not line the coffers of an enemy. And the cities known as Atlanta and Birmingham and Miami, white cities all, they were laid waste to. And the majestic blacks, their muscular backs gleaming with clean sweat, they sang into existence glorious temples to honor their predecessors. And these edifices excited the skyline with shapes too astounding for whites to envision. And within these mammoth villas, the brothers and sisters lived in perfect accord with all animals, in impeccable harmony with nature and the spirit world. The few whites allowed to set eyes upon the wonders of Blacktopia, they retreated in weeping awe. And to preserve their stubborn caveman fantasy of superiority, these white men loudly and vehemently claimed the jeweled palaces and interplanetary flying pyramids were lies and outright illusions. And when the sisters had eradicated all forms of cancer from Blacktopia, jealous whites demanded proof. And what proof can be provided of what does not exist? For in their wisdom, the sisters had sourced the ageless spirits and enlisted those haunts to banish cancer and AIDS and herpes until not a single black was afflicted. And while the whites strived to increase their numbers, white science and technology stalled. And certain whites were not above infiltrating Blacktopia to plunder its brilliance. For white science and mathematics had been harnessed only to build atomic bombs, while black intellect yielded, daily, new wonders that enriched life, especially the lives of women. For Blacktopia held its sisters as its greatest treasure. And following the pattern of white men such as journalist John Griffin, who darkened his face with methoxylin and ultraviolet light and slithered forth to appropriate black achievement and black experience and present it as his own in the book Black Like Me, and in doing so make his fortune. In the same way, white men of Caucasia masked themselves and wormed their way across the border. Such folly! For the whites knew only to mimic the ridiculous elaborate handshakes and saggy pants gibberish speak the blacks had affected, and the brothers recognized at once these shuffling impostors, would-be thieves, these squabbling, gun-waving, hip-shaking, crotch-grabbing crackers in blackface. They were humored and led to believe they'd successfully infiltrated Blacktopia. There, the brothers schooled them to partake of their own urine as a supposed cure for cancer. And the would-be cultural thieves ran home, and pretty much all whites adopted the practice. The instruction sheet specified machine washable only, and durability. Gavin pulled the dry cleaner's plastic off his favorite sand shirt and undid the buttons. He looped it off the hanger. So tailored. The oranges and reds so saturated. He'd worn it twice, afraid he might stain it or that the colors would fade. Holding the collar tucked under his chin, he folded the shirt against his chest, matching the sleeves. He folded the folded shirt a second time and a third to make a smooth, neat packet he placed into the empty suitcase on his bed. A voice, not his mother's. His sister, Charm, said, "That's so not the right shirt." She stood leaning sideways in his doorway, her arms crossed. Charm held up a stop sign hand to hush any backtalk. She went to the open closet, and her shoulders slumped in resignation. The array of retro cowboy shirts with pearlized snaps, the Dolce knockoff pullovers with metallicized detailing, vintage Versace. Before her was the trousseau Gavin had built for his adult life, his homosexual hope chest, as it were. His sister plucked at the front of her own army surplus uniform shirt. "This will wear like iron." Olive drab. Untucked, the tails hung halfway to the knees of her blue jeans. The closest thing she could find in his closet was a thrift store shirt of canvas-like khaki-green material, enlivened with embroidered patches, a second-hand Boy Scout uniform complete with Eagle Scout badge. Gavin protested, "It's permanent press." Charm tossed aside the sand shirt and replaced it with the khaki. "It's not a fashion show," she said. "It's a concentration camp." The Talbot book called the place the Inventory Retention Center. Until recently, until Adjustment Day, the particular one where Gavin had been assigned, had been a low-security prison. The year of initial relocation neared its end. Those born into the wrong homeland, homosexuals born to heterosexuals, or those with an inappropriate preponderance of sub-Saharan or Caucasoid DNA, they'd be surrendered by their source families to government custody until a like misbirth in the appropriate homeland could be identified for exchange. Somewhere in Gaysia, God willing, an 18-year-old heterosexual was packing a suitcase, headed for a similar holding camp. After almost 2 decades of being fed, dressed, and educated, Gavin and his ilk represented too big an investment to be left unattended. If they attempted to emigrate illegally or escape to Canada or to commit suicide, the nation stood to lose a sizable export commodity. He wondered idly if there was an underground railroad to allow misbirths a more speedy path to their rightful homeland, to sidestep the normal wait for a suitable candidate for the exchange. A system of safe houses, human traffickers, Maybe there existed coyotes he could pay to guide him through the borderlands. Charm pulled out the top drawer of the bureau and dug among Gavin's socks. Of these, she selected two pairs dark blue, three black, a pair plain green, and six pairs of white sweat socks. Tucking them into the suitcase, she said, "At least you're not baby-making machinery for some chieftain." Fat chance she'd end up a chieftain's wife, not with her sunburned face and cropped hair. Another reason he was surrendering for retention and export. If an equivalent trade wasn't available, the accepting homeland would have to pay upwards of 500,000 talbots in compensation. Gavin's parents could use the money. Even Charm had to know that. They could buy a business, a small farm. Seed corn, livestock, all the staples they'd need to be self-sufficient in the new economy. Otherwise, they'd become like all their other fellow former white-collar, former information technology, former paper-pushing professionals. To survive, they'd need to submit themselves as serfs to a local chieftain. Others might hightail it for the border, or suck death from the tailpipe in a closed garage. But with some patience, Gavin figured this could end as a win-win. He'd assimilate in Geysia, and his source family would own their livelihood and their freedom. His sister knelt beside the bed and reached underneath, pulling out tennis shoes and loafers. A pair of each she bagged in plastic grocery sacks and nestled into the suitcase, beside a folded pair of cargo shorts she'd selected. Shorts Gavin hated. These sat on top of camo pants she'd recommended, because they'd never show stains. Sandwiched between these, she placed a plastic Tupperware box containing his toothbrush, his razor, toothpaste, and comb. His sand shirt, beautiful and impractical in all its orange plaid glory, lay on the bed where she'd relegated it. What his sister said next, he didn't catch. "I asked," Charm repeated, "did you hear about that guy Walter?" Gavin looked around his room for a long last time. "Walter who?" she prompted. "Who used to go with Shasta from school?" He shook his head. "Why?" His sister looked at the space remaining in the suitcase. She pulled a heavy wool sweater and a lighter cotton one from the top shelf of the closet. These she balled up and packed. Back at the bureau, she ignored the Andrew Christian microfiber-stylized butt-bearing athletic supporters in favor of his old-school Y-front tighty-whities. She rolled up a baggy pair of drawstring shorts she said could do double duty as swimwear. She asked something. Gavin asked, "Again?" Lightly. As if he were only going off to summer camp for the rest of his life, his sister asked, "Miss me?" He told himself there would be better clothes, better everything in his future. Better than everything he'd be forced to leave behind. Clothes and love enough he'd never give a second thought to the pathetic wardrobe he'd bought with his lawn mowing and dog walking wages. Out there, somewhere, was a love that would make him forget his sister and his source parents. The suitcase filled, Charm said, "Don't worry. It will be fun," she said. "Who knows?" But it was only her mouth saying it. He caught sight of her in the mirror over his bureau. As his back was turned, she secretively lifted the beautiful orange plaid shirt and tucked it beneath all the practical, long-lasting denim and canvas. She closed the suitcase and zippered it shut. As the housekeeper coiled strands of hair into tight pin curls, Miss Josephine leaned forward over an open book. Heavy in her lap lay a fly-specked copy of Gone with the Wind. And as her eyes scanned Margaret Mitchell's dialogue, Miss Josephine's lips silently mouthed the dialectic patois. Her lips stung, as she pressed them with coarse grains of rock salt. Her lips stung and swelled until they'd begun to split, and she could taste the blood mixed with salt on her tongue. On the surface of the vanity in front of her sat her dentures. The teeth almost glowed with coat upon coat of pearlized white fingernail polish. In the dark, total darkness, they would glow due to phosphorescent dyes Miss Jo had added to the polish. Beyond the book, the image she saw in the mirror delighted her. Methoxylin, like John Griffin used when writing Black Like Me, it had worked its magic. Just as it had for that Spriggle man, the reporter who'd taken massive doses of the drug in 1948 and toured the South to write his book in the land of Jim Crow. Not to be outdone, the reporter Grace Housel had gone blackface to write her own tome in 1969, Soul Sister. Nosy American news hounds were always blacking up and writing about their madcap adventures. Not that they'd invented the trick. Al Jolson in 1927, Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll as Amos and Andy in 1928, Judy Garland as early as 1938's Everybody Sing, and then again with Mickey Rooney in 1941 for Babes on Broadway. All it took was 30 milligrams of methoxylin, followed by time under a sun lamp. Even now, ultraviolet lights shone on Miss Jo from each of several different angles, evenly exposing her bare arms, her legs, neck, and face as she perspired daintily in her lace chemise. The side effects might include headaches, dizziness, insomnia, and nausea, but that hadn't stopped the lovely Ava Gardner from playing a beautiful black siren in Showboat. Nor had possible kidney damage dissuaded Jean Crane from becoming a pretty black girl child in 1949's landmark film, Pinky. As late as 1965, Laurence Olivier had risked his health to play the black Othello. Liver damage was the threat with methoxylin, as was cancer. Even now, Miss Josephine's head swam, her vision blurred. But these were a small price to pay for a miracle drug that allowed white people to become black people. Not that Arabella understood. The silly woman yanked on another strand of hair and twisted it around a bobby pin. Most of the hair lay tight against her scalp, in similar little knots. For the next step, the housekeeper would apply the perm solution. She'd wait just a little too long before applying the stopping agent. She'd use pineapple juice because it offered the perfect acidity. By waiting a smidgen too long, they'd burn the hair a mite. After the pins were out, once Miss Jo fluffed the kinked, tightly curled hair, it would stand around her face like a lush onyx halo. Dyed, of course. Between the pain of her hair being pulled at and the queasiness in her tummy, her salted, swelled-up lips and her sweaty skin, Miss Jo struggled to pronounce the antiquated talk just as Mitchell had written it. The reflection that stared back from her vanity mirror hardly resembled Ava Gardner's enchanting character Julie Laverne. But that newly minted person would be Miss Jo's escape from the strain of her current tenuous circumstance. Exactly as Talbot Reynolds had asked, Walter had launched the list online. First, people had joked about it. No, first they'd ignored it. Only after they'd noticed, then they'd ridiculed the site. Once it had garnered a few million postings, some people had taken offense and demanded it be banned. These had been mostly the people whose names drew the most votes, the politicians and academics and media celebrities. Walter had sat in the basement of the abandoned house and refreshed his screen every hour and marveled at the response. He'd asked Talbot, "How do we monetize?" He'd had in mind buying houses, the big scheme he'd dreamt up to seduce Shasta. Talbot is always tied to a chair, Talbot woozy with blood loss and dappled with scabs and razor blade scars, he'd said. "Write down these names," As his infected cuts drained, he proceeded to rattle off a dozen names that Walter had hurriedly scribbled on his pad. "Search online," Talbot had commanded. "Contact each man." Walter perused the list. "This will make me rich?" Feverish, glassy-eyed, Walter's new old man had asked, "You? I should make you rich?" Walter had hit refresh and tried to hide his annoyance. He'd considered adding Talbot's name to the list. Now he'd have to hunt down these dozen men and most likely contact them. Lately, Talbot had seemed to be baiting him. This entire scheme might have been the old man's snipe hunt. The old man had rallied. "To make your fortune," he'd advised, "buy fake fur." Walter had repeated, "Fake?" The old man nodded gravely. "Fur. Naga hide," he'd intoned. "Pleather, too." His head had settled to one side, asleep. Walter had hit refresh. A musician followed them at a distance, piping a soft melody on a recorder. An array of peacocks fanned the air with their exotic tails as Shasta strolled past, her arm delicately linked with Charlie's. The gardens fell away on every side, planted in elaborate patterns of fennel and asparagus. The matter of her saliva had reared its ugly head yet again. In the olden times, prior to Adjustment Day, boys had pressured her for fellatio. Charlie only bullied her for a genetic sample to prove her ethnicity. She'd been putting him off for weeks, placating him with oral sex and fetishistic nurse costumes, but today, he'd fallen into a sullen pout. As they walked, their silence broken only by the recorder and the frequent screams of peacocks, the answer occurred to her. A girl she'd known in college, a free spirit Shasta had all but forgotten. Charm. A girl like none other. Only charm was charm. In world mythologies, Dr. Brawley had taught them ancient Greek legends of Bellerophon, the hero who tamed the flying horse Pegasus. He'd battled and defeated the all-girl legions of the Amazons, and he'd slaughtered the dragon Chimera. Undefeated, he'd bade the god Poseidon to flood the nation of Xanthus. But the womenfolk of Xanthus had confronted the approaching waves. These enterprising females had lifted their skirts and faced the ocean with their girl parts fully bared. Cross-culturally, from Europe to Indonesia and South America, the ancient world had believed that exposed pussies would always frighten away evil. Up until the 18th century, above the doorways and gateways of castles and churches, masons had carved images of women squatting to reveal themselves. Neither Satan nor any evil could endure the sight of the female sex organs, it was said. Confronted by all the vaginas of Xanthus, the tides receded in fear. The waves retreated, and Bellerophon met defeat. Even the flying Pegasus had freaked out and bolted away. Walking arm in arm with Charlie, Shasta reflected on what had happened not long after that study module on the ancient world. Charm had apparently taken the lesson to heart. Back in those weeks before Adjustment Day, when the doomed surplus of males of the youth bulge had come courting, she'd put her recent education to good use. The boys' varsity lacrosse team had, on one occasion, encircled her in an otherwise deserted hallway. Playfully, the aggressive teens had endeavored to mouth her breasts through her sweater and to goose her with their mechanical pencils. Rather than pity them as imminent cannon fodder, Charm had readily applied the teachings of antiquity. As they danced around her, Charm had simply lifted the front of her skimpy cheerleader skirt. Unmasked by underclothes, it had been fully exposed. Her vulva. Weaned on the tame, hairless vaginas of pornography, The young men had recoiled in terror. As a charging army of hairy vaginas had spooked the winged stallion Pegasus, Charms's hirsute sexual center had shocked those would-be suitors. As their jeering had fallen silent, she'd clenched her buttocks, thrusting her sex at them like a deadly saber. Panicked, they'd toppled backward, they'd scrambled to their feet and fled. But even as they'd raced in retreat, Charm had kept her skirt raised and charged them with her thrusting strawberry blonde pubic hair, so much like the ruff around the devouring mouth of a ferocious African lion. As if to add to this impression, she emitted snarls and roars, as if the pussy itself had suddenly found its own savage voice. Shasta had witnessed the rout take place, the playful flirting followed by the assault with the unbridled vagina. She'd watched Charm chase the lacrosse boys as far as the faculty parking lot. As the terrified youngsters had disappeared into the distance, Shasta had risked approaching the bold girl. A gal like that, even then reverting back to her normal self, smoothing her skirt down and reapplying her pink lip gloss, this girl would be a freethinker. She'd been the ultimate in white beauty, combing her long blonde hair and regarding the world through glacial blue eyes. Back then, she'd been young and lithe, and there'd already been some hint of the crusty old broad about Charm. She'd never shrink from a challenge. Alone with such a girl, Shasta had ventured to ask, "How's it going?" The two girls had their mythology in common, but that was all. The pale skin that covered Charm's classic Nordic features had flushed as if suddenly self-conscious. Perhaps she too realized that her pelvic attack on the silly gaggle of harmless teens had been unnecessarily harsh. "Hi, Shasta," she'd stammered. Shasta didn't let slip that she'd observed the goings-on with the rowdy team. She'd continued, "Have you seen Walter around?" The Aryan bombshell had cocked her small head in confusion. An abundance of straight golden hair had tumbled to that side. "Walter who?" asked the girl. "Here at Merrihill, promenading in the gardens, Shasta had the ear and the heart of one of Caucasia's most powerful chieftains. She must be able to offer such a girl some incentive. If they could strike a bargain, perhaps they could both benefit from Shasta's long-range scheme." Charlie, he remained mute. He merely surveyed his realm. Below this portion of the gardens, the terrain fell away to fertile fruited plains that stretched to the horizon. In the distance, sunburned fieldwives stooped to tend to young seedlings. Among the bounty, Shasta could recognize wide swaths of delicious radishes, densely planted bush beans, the tendrils of cucumber vines. The hard life of a fieldwife was an improvement over starving in the settlement houses of Portland, but it was a far cry from the status of public wife that Shasta stood to achieve. Despite their lowly station, more than a smattering of field wives wielded big pregnant tummies that had to be Charlie's doing. His kingdom, like those of any chieftain, consisted of one king and hordes of female workers, the opposite of a beehive or termite mound. In the sky directly overhead, a formation of jumbo jetliners was escorting the last of the Asian genotypes back to their native continent. Shasta watched them go with despair.